Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.
Welcome to Living in the Solution with Dr. Elena George. Today we have a return guest, somebody who we spoke with about a year ago, and I wanted to have him come back to get his take on some of the things that we don't speak about. And one of the things that is really affecting everybody now is homelessness. And it seems to me that it's grown exponentially, but I really wanted to get a handle on how we got here. A lot of things that go on have a nidus or a source. For healthcare, it's the corporatization, for example, and the consolidation of our healthcare system that has changed how people access it and the cost. And so I wanted to find out if there was some sort of nucleus, some sort of thing that triggered this homeless crisis, because I think it preceded COVID, something that has mushroomed since COVID. So we're going to speak with Mr. Wesley Smith. He's a lawyer and award-winning author. He's also a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute Center on Human Exceptionalism. He's also a consultant to the Patients' Rights Council. In 2004, because of his work in bioethics, he was named one of the nation's premier expert thinkers in bioengineering by the National Journal. In 2008, the Human Life Foundation named him a great defender of life for his work against assisted suicide and euthanasia. He left full-time practice of law in 1985 to pursue a career in writing and public advocacy. He's the author or co-author of 14 books, and he's a regular contributor to the National Review Online's blog, The Corner, where he focuses on issues that impact human life and dignity. And I think, Mr. Smith, that's one of the major things that underpins homelessness, dignity and human life. And it seems to me that it's not something that people are really keying in on or taking it for granted. And all the solutions that we seem to come up with, I think, have made it worse. You wrote an article, Housing First Caused the Homelessness Catastrophe. And I wanted to get you to speak about that because it's something that affects every human being in our society.
Yes, thank you, Dr. George. Really happy to be on with you again. Human dignity encompasses a lot of areas, you know, the issues of life, the issues of death, and so forth. But I also think it involves the homeless issue. And my think tank, the Discovery Institute, has recently put out a report on this issue, and that's what got me really thinking about it. And if anybody is interested, they can go to the www.discovery.org for the report, How Congress Can Reform Government's Misguided Homelessness Policies. And it's actually co-authored by President Trump's homelessness czar, I guess is sometimes the term, the fellow Robert Marbot, who was the person in the Trump administration who dealt with this issue. I think the homelessness issue is caused by many things, but one of them is policy. And there is a policy known as Housing First that started around 2013 under the Obama administration. And the idea behind Housing First is that we will give grants to nonprofit organizations and so forth to help provide housing for people who are on the streets. And that's fine, but there was a problem with that. The Housing First policy did away or actually prohibited any requirement that somebody who receives that kind of assistance not take drugs. And of course, we know that the drug addiction is a big cause of the problem. Mm-hmm. They not to have any responsibilities to look for work or to engage in job training and this kind of thing. And so you ended up with the situation in which billions of dollars have gone to pay for housing vouchers and to try to find people roofs over their heads. On the other hand, there's been no requirement that the people receiving such help do anything. And that has left open a lot of dysfunction that isn't being addressed. I mean, some these people will may get offered, for example, rehab, but they don't have to take it. They don't have to promise not to do drugs. They don't have to not do drugs. They don't have to promise not to drink. They don't have to promise to take the medication that they receive for mental illness and so forth. And so that's that I think has added to the problem, because organizations, for example, like the Salvation Army, which has a really good record of helping people in this kind of circumstance, aren't able to get public funding because they do have requirements that people who get help obey certain rules. And also the Obama administration put in a law that said you can't give funding to religiously based organizations. And many of the best rehab organizations are organizations to help rehabilitate people so that they aren't homeless, which is, should be the goal. The goal should be people being self-sustaining, you know, if they're capable of that, are religious organizations, rescue missions, and things of this sort. And they are unable to get funding from the government precisely because they, A, are religious, and B, have requirements for people who seek help in getting off the streets. So I think that was a big cause. Obviously, drug addiction is a huge cause. Mental illness, the closing of mental hospitals. Medicaid, for example, has limited payments to pay for mental hospital help, which some of these unfortunate people need. And we also don't have any kind of, I think, pressure or thinking about what we owe the homeless, we think a lot about. What they owe us, we don't think much about at all. And it seems to me that people who are homeless, who have the capability of restoring themselves to dignity, owe us that. They owe us not defecating in the streets. They owe us not shooting up on the streets. They owe us not dropping needles in the playgrounds and so forth. So we have to get back to a circumstance in which people who find themselves in deep difficulty can get help. We want to help people, but they also have to have the ability or responsibility to not only accept help, but help themselves.
Well, I have a couple of questions about this process. If it's not the religious organizations, who are they spending the money on to help the homeless? Are these NGOs? Is it the government?
Yeah, NGOs that are homelessness activists and so forth.
Uh-huh.
And many of these organizations and groups have an ideological belief against the kind of reciprocity that I was just discussing.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually work hard to intervene to keep these tent cities from being cleaned up, file lawsuits and so forth to prevent. In fact, this San Francisco was just complaining, which is, you know, one of the epicenters of this catastrophe that we're experiencing as a country. And there was a lawsuit that prevented even modest attempts by San Francisco to clean up the city from going forth. And so you find that in many ways, there's paralysis, because you have a group of activists who are well-funded, who want to just basically allow the homeless to do whatever they wish, even if it means squalor in the city, versus people who would like to see cleanup and rules that would require people to help participate in their own rehabilitation. And it's a very difficult circumstance at the moment.
It sounds like the truism of follow the money applies here. If they get rid of the homeless, these NGOs are gone, so they have to create the perpetual problem, so they're perpetually needed. Is that a way to see it?
And the problem is the federal government funding has the homelessness first, or housing first approach. Many states have a similar approach. So that's not only the federal money that restricts what the recipients of funds can do to help the homeless, but state money and local money, cities like Seattle, cities like San Francisco and Los Angeles, have also joined this Housing First parade, which has failed abysmally. In 2013, as the report shows from the Discovery Institute, we were promised that by 2023, this problem would be done. And of course, it's worse than it's ever been. And the idea that we're going to just continue doing what we've been doing, which is making clearly the circumstance worse and worse and worse, is just irrational to me.
I mean, it sounds exactly like the war. Anytime there's a war on something, you seem to get more of it. And one of the things, isn't it? I mean, you've got the war on drugs and people are going, this makes absolutely no sense unless it's what you want, you know? But my second corollary question to this is, from a critical thinking standpoint, if you're trying to get people into housing and into society, but you don't want to teach them skills, get them mentally stable, put them in a position to succeed, what on earth are you doing?
Well, you're making it so that you've always got work, don't you?
Yeah.
You've always got a need to help people. And if you don't solve the problem, if you solve the problem, you might be out of a job. I hate to be cynical, but I also think that it's ideological. That is, I think that there are people, there are organizations and groups in this society that seem to want the society to fail. And certainly the Housing First approach has failed. And the fact that we're not doing anything, at least at this point, to fix that policy, there are proposals we can get into, something called Housing Plus. And it indicates to me that there are powerful forces in this country that kind of don't want this catastrophe to be remedied for whatever reason that might be.
That's really tragic. I mean, you mentioned this happening in a prior administration, but how come it hasn't changed? We had a change of political parties. We had a change, majority in Congress, and nothing seems to have gotten done. Isn't that why?
Yeah, and that's true. And part of the problem in terms of the last administration, because Robert Marbot was brought in to try to begin to make some of these changes, and COVID stopped everything cold.
Mm-hmm.
So he wasn't able to engage in some of the activities that he wanted to. But there is an approach now being promoted in Congress called Housing Plus. And that would allow, of course, funding for putting roofs over people's heads. But it also would do away with that religious discrimination problem that I discussed. It would allow for organizations like the Salvation Army to receive funding, and for organizations that require the recipients of help to comply with certain requirements. And so I think that is, people are beginning to think about it,
mm-hmm.
But I don't think, the homelessness issue doesn't have a high political constituency. They don't have major corporations on K Street in Washington, D.C., looking to create laws that benefit them particularly in the sense that we're talking about hoping to fix it. And we all want to look away from this issue because it's very painful to look at. But the catastrophes of miles of homeless squalor tent cities, block after block after block, of people being unable to enjoy the peaceability and the freedom of downtowns, with downtowns beginning to shutter businesses because of rampant crime, which isn't necessarily just the homeless, obviously, but you have district attorneys, for example, in San Francisco and other cities that refuse to enforce shoplifting laws. And I spoke with one head of a rescue union, a rescue mission that it has a religious perspective, And he said, when, and this is really raised my eyebrows, he said that when the district attorneys don't enforce the laws against theft, that just creates an ability for drug addicts to fund their habits. And it just creates a continuing loop of destructive behavior until many are dying on the streets, especially with the fentanyl crisis, you know?
Exactly.
And it's not preserving the dignity of these people. It's denying their dignity. It's allowing our fellow brothers and sisters to live in utter squalor and lack of, I mean, consider the self-loathing that one must possess to defecate in the streets, or there's now these zombie drugs where they're just people standing in the streets, stooped over because they're so addled by these drugs that are hitting the market. Also, when you think about fentanyl crisis, you have to bring in the immigration issue. I mean, our southern border, the cartels from Mexico are pouring drugs into this country, and fentanyl in particular, which is very deadly. And the ingredients to make the fentanyl is being sent to them by China. And yet nothing seems to be done about those issues either.
You have to question whether this is, from a standpoint of protecting your country, this is more than, it's a moral issue, it's an ethical issue, and it's also an act of,
National security issue.
Exactly.
And these are the numbers we're talking about. In this Discovery Institute study, they went to aggregate the numbers. Right now, there are close to 1.2 million adults experiencing profound housing insecurity. Some are on the streets, you know, hundreds of thousands are literally on the streets. Some are in like single room occupancy hotels with temporary ability to stay there and so forth. There are also, and it's a different statistic, there are 1,508,000 children experiencing this kind of homelessness or housing insecurity. Some are living with their parents in cars and this kind of thing. In the total of people with housing insecurity, either on the streets or in temporary circumstances, receiving vouchers or whatever, is approaching 3 million people.
That's a large.
And many advocates think we're undercounting the people who are literally on the streets, adults and children under the age of 5, for example, because a lot of the children's statistics come from the Department of Education because of what the schools learn. And, that's about as many people as the city of Chicago are homelessness.
Tragic.
Are experiencing housing insecurity in this country. And that's a disgrace.
It is, absolutely. On that note, let's take our first break and come back. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living in Solution. We're speaking with Mr. Wesley Smith. And prior to the break, you did a wonderful job of giving us this visual experience of what these people are going through. My question now is an ethical and moral one. We've went through an entire 4 years of pitting people against each other, hating on each other. And it seems to me with the rhetoric of caring about people, we've actually produced a situation where people are living in with people doing drugs on the street. What's going on with the people living in these cities? How do they walk past, walk over, basically live a separate life while this situation is going on? I'm not really hearing. Now I am, because it's affecting everybody. But there was no outcry. This was like a good thing at one point, was it not?
I wouldn't say it was a good thing, but most people were, in cities that were very prosperous, were able to actually kind of stay away from the areas which were collapsing into anarchy. And that's what we're talking about here,
mm-hmm.
isn't it?
It
anarchy,
is.
Social anarchy, and people who are engaged in behaviors that at one time would have been utterly unacceptable. But I don't think people are happy with it. I think you're seeing a lot of people voting with their feet and moving away from these cities. The tax bases are beginning to collapse. San Francisco, for example, is losing many of its businesses. There was just a terrible story. And I lived in and near San Francisco from 1992 to early 2017. So I know that city quite well. And there was a wonderful anchor store in downtown San Francisco on Market Street called Nordstrom's. Five stories, really very beautifully maintained and so forth, nice merchandise. And there was a whole shopping center associated with that Nordstrom's. That Nordstrom's, if you can believe it, has just closed. It just closed. It closed because employees didn't feel safe. People were not coming into the city to shop because of what we've just been discussing. The crime was rampant, shoplifting and so forth. So the city of San Francisco lost a huge department store that brought not only tax money from the sale of merchandise at that Nordstrom, but also brought people into the city to go to the restaurants. Maybe combined going to the city to do some shopping with taking in a show, you know, after dinner, this kind of thing. And I have been told, I haven't seen it for myself, but I've been told that Union Square, which is the heart of upscale San Francisco, half the stores are now shuttered. And a San Francisco institution, Gump's, which was a department store, is closing. This is unthinkable. I mean, San Francisco has had policies that have created such a collapse for that city. But the two things it always had going for it, even as when I left the city, things were beginning to get bad. They weren't as bad as they are now. But you'd get off the BART, which is the subway system, and you'd have to step sometimes over people sleeping in the stations and this kind of thing. It's much worse now. But the two things that San Francisco always had was high tech, you know, the Silicon Valley stuff, the tech workers who liked living in a city that had a very progressive morality for its social policies. And you had tourism and conventions, because San Francisco should be a world-class city. And you have the trolley cars, and you have the bay, and you have Alcatraz as an attraction, Fisherman's Wharf. It's a gorgeous city. And there was convention after convention after convention, these huge convention centers that filled the hotels. The conventions are drying up. The tourism is drying up. The Hilton in downtown San Francisco apparently is closing or is being sold by its owner. You have a situation in which the city is imploding and crime is, particularly property crime, is rampant. And I don't see anything being done to correct it. And I remember, Dr. George, in 2019, my wife and I took a vacation to Egypt. We did a Nile cruise. And I remember walking around Cairo, which is a city, a huge city in a very poor country, a developing country. And it was cleaner than San Francisco. Wow. And I mentioned to my wife at that time, I said, this is disgraceful. Cairo's better maintained than the city that we live near. I used to live near. At that time, we left California. It was cleaner than San Francisco. I was struck by that. And the inexcusability of having a city as beautiful as San Francisco, as beautiful as Seattle, which is suffering the same discord and dysfunction, as beautiful as Los Angeles, where I grew up in LA. I lived in Los Angeles until my early 40s. And I know LA like the back of my hand. And it's having a collapse. And it's having a collapse because of a multiple dysfunctions of policy. And the problem is the voters keep voting for the same people who are causing this. So at some point in a free country, you get what you ask for.
See, that was the underpinning of my question. Where's the ethical and moral underpinning of this? Is this a progressive policy that it just disregards that? I mean, how could you, for example, not want everybody involved, whether you're a church group, a secular group? It's about fixing the problem, not acing people out to prove a point or push your agenda forward. So I guess the bigger question I have is, where's the ethics and morals in these supposed people first progressive policies? Or are there any?
Well, I guess that's in the eye of the beholder. The people who support these policies, I think, believe that they are being compassionate and that they, you know, that in this equity agenda, which doesn't push equality of opportunity, but equality of outcomes, and that doesn't work. It doesn't work. I mean, particularly if people are unable to or incapable of or refuse, as often happens, to help themselves. You also have, I think, a problem where our mental institutions, sometimes for good reason, because some of these places were barbaric, have been closed. And so we do not have the infrastructure available to treat people with serious mental illnesses. And what was supposed to happen back, gosh, I guess it was in the 80s, that the institutions were going to close and then they were going to create community clinics to help people with mental illnesses. Well, many of the institutions were emptied, but the local clinics were never opened.
No.
And so we now have a circumstance in which there are not nearly enough mental health beds to take care of people who should be institutionalized. There's a woeful lack of community and support, and the people who would provide that from a religious perspective tend to get a bit starved for funds because they're not able to get mass funding except what they can raise themselves. And a lot of these institutions like the Rescue Missions and Salvation Army and others like that are doing good work and they're helping people. But I think a lot more people could be helped if some of the changes that we discussed in the first section were made so that religious groups could, you know, you're not going to impose religion on people you're helping, but that people who have a religious basis, Salvation Army, et cetera, could receive funding. That's not the establishment of a church as against the First Amendment. It's common sense to allow various approaches then to compete with each other to see what works best. But right now you just have housing vouchers. If you want to go into rehab, here's a phone number, as opposed to, you know what? We're going to put a roof over your head. But what we're going to require of you now is to work in the kitchen and help prepare meals. And 3 days a week, I'm just, you know, using a hypothetical, go to these rehabilitation classes or go into a rehabilitation clinic itself. And unless we start saying that the duties of dignity are mutual, the society to help the people who are in this unfortunate, awful circumstance, and those people who can help themselves to do so, will never reach the ultimate goal, which is self-sufficiency.
I have to put it out there that maybe self-sufficiency is not the end goal of any of this. And, you know, we're having a housing crisis. During COVID, tell me, did the CDC, you know, not being able to charge people who you rent, the renters didn't have to pay for several, I guess, over years or so, right? How did that affect this? Did it make it just that much harder for people to move into actual physical housing?
You know, I don't know the answer to that, but I do know that housing costs have shot through the roof. And I haven't done a study or focused on the causes of that. But that is another problem that needs to be looked into. Why are housing prices going up so high? Is it because, and this is, I don't know the answer to this, so I'm asking a question.
Mm-hmm.
Is it because we've got a couple of million people being brought in from south of the border every year, people who need roofs over their heads? Has that caused a shortage of available housing? We certainly know that a lot of hotel rooms that might be used for the homelessness are being used to house people who are asking for refugee status, but won't have a hearing on that for years, if they have a hearing at all. I'm not saying that's the cause. I'm asking, is that possibly a cause? What about the problem of, in many areas, particularly progressive areas, of making it hard to build new housing? There was a story in the LA Times on this Housing First issue where they were building, you know, a little one-room apartment.
Mm-hmm.
And these little one-room apartments were costing $800,000 each. Now, what is that? We're not talking about building a 4,000, 5,000 square foot house. We're talking about building small, let's say 400, 500 square foot units. And they were costing $800,000 each. That was a story in the LA Times. Well, where's that money going? It certainly doesn't cost that much for the construction materials necessary. And I doubt whether the workers are getting paid, $500,000 to build each one of these. So I'd be very interested to know where that money went. I don't know the answer, but that's a scandal in itself too. So we make it harder to build quality, low-cost housing. We have policies that prevent actual recovery efforts to be required in order to receive help. We don't have nearly enough mental health facilities for people who actually need it because they're so mentally ill they can't help themselves. We don't have sufficient ability to force people not to take drugs, which is a big part of the problem. We have law enforcement for quality of life crimes that is not being applied. You know, it's called the broken windows policy. And back when Rudy Giuliani first became mayor of New York, he started enforcing quality of life crimes. Stopping graffiti, misdemeanors, called the broken windows policy. If somebody relieved themselves on the sidewalk, they could be arrested and so forth. And it really helped clean up the city because the theory was that if you focus on some of these misdemeanors that involve how a city looks, its upkeep and so forth, you will improve the quality of life for the entire city and you'll reduce crime. And that worked. Well, that's now been abandoned after Mayor Bloomberg's time ended. And we now see that the broken windows policy has been proved in a negative sense, that when you stop enforcing quality of life crimes, when you stop prosecuting theft, you end up with squalor. So we need to reinstitute the broken windows policy over time, and hopefully you'll end up with a renaissance. But at the moment, I'm struck by our inability or unwillingness, perhaps because we think it's more compassionate, to actually engage in the kind of structured policies that would, I think, begin to make a difference. And instead, we're sliding into increased dysfunction, dissipation, and decadence.
It certainly seems like the underpinning or the beginning of this slippery slope was this Housing First legislation.
That's the conclusion, one of the major conclusions of this Discovery Institute study that I referenced. And again, it was written by Robert Marbot and Bruce Chapman. Bruce Chapman is the CEO, but Robert Marbot is an expert in this field. He has worked this field for literally decades, and he knows what he's talking about. And I hope that people will go to the Discovery or Institute, www.discovery.org, and find the report, because it really does set forth in great detail what went wrong and offers many options for change and reform that hopefully could help turn the situation around.
Well, in the next segment, I want to go into more detail about how some of these, you know, changes and proposals, and also what we can do. You know, we're all in this society together. You just described just a disaster in San Francisco with viable businesses just leaving. Where does that leave everybody? It becomes like a Wild West with nobody. I mean, either you're in that system or you want to get out as fast as you can. And for those that can't afford to leave, they're just, it's like being in prison. I can't even imagine what that would be like when you can't even go out and enjoy yourself, or you have to look over your shoulder, or God forbid you do have something and they come for you and there's nobody to protect you, no police, no nothing. And, you know, we have, again, it seems like this was a unfolding event, because we had the time between Antifa and Black Lives Matter, those years where it really was open season on small businesses, on citizens, where they've just got their property destroyed with no recourse. Did that set, in your opinion, kind of the table for where we are now? Everybody's just become apathetic, or they just want to get out of there and just leave it?
Yeah, I think that a lot of people have given up on improvements and are thinking about how to best protect themselves in the circumstance in which they find themselves. So you find a lot of, I think, hundreds of thousands of people have left California. Well, that's, I think Reagan, Ronald Reagan used to call that voting with your feet. He was talking about a different voting in terms of East Berlin and so forth, but that's voting with your feet. People are moving to other states where this crisis is not so bad, like Florida. Then you have the problem in terms of, you talked about police. Police have been so disrespected that a lot have refused to stay in the profession. And a lot of people are not, who might have otherwise become good cops, are refusing to apply. They don't want to. They see police as potential victims of a great deal of lawlessness and lack of respect, and also often being blamed in terms of law enforcement if they make a mistake. Now, you know, that doesn't justify the cases of police brutality, which of course have happened and should be punished. But the police, there's a crisis now in policing throughout the country, where many big city police forces are down hundreds and hundreds of officers from what they should be having and what they used to have. And of course, that affects the quality of life in the city too, and leads to a situation where, you know, people are worried about their safety.
This is not a society that is sustainable from what you're describing. It's just these pockets, but it has the potential to break out from those little enclaves and affect the entire country. On that note, let's take our last break, because I want to talk about what you feel are solutions that we can start. We need to turn the tide on this as fast as possible. So let's take our last break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living a Solution. We're speaking with Mr. Wesley Smith, and he's the author of several books. I think people need to go and read them. One of his most recent books, or a recent book in 2016, was called Culture of Death, The Age of Do Harm Medicine. I think that's timely in the situation that we find ourselves in. Where can people buy your books, Mr. Smith? Is it on in Amazon, or do you have a website?
Oh, yeah. Thank you. It's available on Amazon. You can still sometimes find them in the stores. It's been a few years. You can special order it at stores, but it's definitely on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and so forth.
People need to go and start really becoming aware and conscious, because it won't work if we're just turning a blind eye and removing ourselves from the situation, because it will follow us, I think. Part of what you talked about initially was, how do we get ourselves out of this? There were some tenets, some legislation that the Discovery Institute were proponents of that can start moving this in the other direction. What would some of those be?
Yeah, the report has, I'm looking at 10 different actions that the Discovery Institute has recommended and is helping work with legislators and so forth to implement. The first, of course, is to pass legislation directing the Housing and Urban Development, Department of Housing and Urban Development, to eliminate housing first as the primary approach to addressing homelessness. This policy of vouchers only or housing first has failed. It has failed abysmally. I don't know how anyone would even defend that it hasn't failed. And if you keep doing it, it's going to fail even more. And so the first step is to make sure that the federal regulations and guidances and so forth do not prevent, in fact, require that people receiving support from the government for these programs, that there also be some service participation by the recipients of the benefits. So doing away with housing first, unless that happens, I don't think anything is going to change. There is a bill that people can look up. It's called Housing Plus, and it's sponsored by Representative Andy Barr of Kentucky. And it's HR 6018, if people want to look up the legislation. And that would prohibit the HUD secretary from restricting or limiting continuing of care funds from going to providers that require supportive services such as addictions, treatment, or job counseling. And it would require that no less than 30% of funding be used by recipients that provide or offer access to wraparound services, the kind of things we've been discussing about. So the third one is prioritize economic self-sufficiency as the primary measurement of effectiveness of all federal homelessness assistance programs. Right now, they measure success by the number of vouchers that are given out. That's not a good answer. What they should be doing in terms of determining whether a program is successful and working or not is prioritize self-sufficiency as the number one measurement of homelessness assistance programs effectiveness. So the idea is, we want you not to need us, we want you to keep needing us, right?
Yeah.
Number four, prioritize trauma-informed wraparound services. 40% of all federal homelessness assistance funding should be used for direct trauma-informed wraparound services, such as mental illness clinic services and treatment, substance use disorder treatment, job training, job retention, and so forth. So the funding would be 60% for housing vouchers and 40% to help people get to the place where they don't need housing vouchers. Number five, require program participation in all federally funded homelessness assistance programs. To receive federal housing support, participants should be required to participate in self-sufficiency, health, life skills, behavioral health services, and so forth, similar to what is supposed to be done with Pell Grants and unemployment insurance. Number six, restore funding for emergency programs. Right now, there is the emergency services are not receiving enough funding, and so there needs to be, this is going to cost money. There is going to need to be a restoration of some of that funding. But again, it isn't that you're spending the money. It's that right now we're spending billions of dollars, like $9 billion a year, and it's not being spent effectively. The suggestion has been made, and I think it's a good one, by the Discovery Institute, that to replace kind of federal funding from the top down with block grant funding for states, because each state has different needs and different populations. So if you give the states the money so they can figure out how it's best to be apportioned, that would be a good way to go, and that would make it less bureaucratic and less top-heavy. Eliminate the institution for mental diseases exclusion in Medicaid. So I didn't know this before I read the report, that Medicaid basically excludes many mentally ill people from the cost of their treatment, sometimes causes a premature termination of treatment. So what the suggestion is that mental illnesses be much more eligible than it is today for Medicaid funding. And that way, when you do that, you'll end up with more mental health beds and more ability to help more people, because mental illness is a huge part of this problem. Number nine, review the budget of the National Institute of Mental Health to ensure that its priorities reflect the actual problems of neglect seen in day-to-day care of mentally ill, especially those who are homeless. And finally, incentivize local governments to eliminate local building fees for affordable housing construction. In other words, make it easier to build housing, not more difficult. And that would create more units for people to live. So this is that's a nutshell answer to at least some reforms that would make a dent in the problem. I think the other part of the problem, which isn't discussed in the report, is there's a moral collapse in this country. And that is going to have to be addressed. I don't think government can do that. I think that's something that churches need to do, synagogues, mosques, and people of goodwill who need to set moral standards again for behavior. Unless we deal with the moral collapse in our country, we will still have people having sex in the streets, dying in the streets, defecating in the streets, taking drugs, dropping needles in playgrounds and so forth, businesses closing, downtown business districts in a state of crisis and so forth. Unless we decide as a people that we're going to say that's unacceptable as a moral matter and start requiring people, not in terms of law, but just in terms of our expectations, to act with a certain level of dignity and self-regard, we're never going to solve this problem.
Sounds like it comes down to holding people accountable and really highlighting personal responsibility. Now it seems it's all community-based. It's the good of the many. It's not about the individual having responsibility for their actions. It's because something happened to them or because society has done so. They don't have a responsibility because they're powerless somehow in this situation.
Our responsibility is to love people. Mm-hmm. And love comes in many forms. And love should be aimed at the particular needs of each individual. Some people are homeless because they've had a terrible string of bad luck, lost jobs, this kind of thing. Those are the easiest people to help because they want to work, right? Mm-hmm. They want to improve their circumstance. Well, let's make sure we get to those people as fast as we can. And of course, a strong economy helps, because the more jobs there are, the more people will be working. But sometimes people need to be told that this drug taking has to stop. And there are eventually, I'm afraid, going to be some people who are going to refuse help and refuse to do anything to help themselves. We're going to have to decide as a people what to do about that, because we can't just let people run amok in downtown city centers creating squalor. And we have to find out what laws can be passed and what policies can be enacted, that when people are recalcitrant and refusing to help themselves, that there's a way that we can make sure that at the very least, they are not defouling cities so that the people who are paying the taxes to keep the cities going can't even use their own communities.
Well, does it come down to legislation? I mean, part of the problem that you described got exacerbated with the revolving door justice system. You can just commit, they're not petty crimes, but they're now acting like they are, robbing people, burglaries, assaults. A lot of these things you don't have to have bail for. Was it Illinois has no, I think they passed a law now, there's no bail, which
no
is
bail. Yeah.
Unbelievable.
New York City has that in New York State. Yeah. Yeah. I think those laws are terribly misguided. You have to not elect district attorneys who run on the plank of not enforcing the law, like the Los Angeles district attorney, who has basically allowed anarchy to reign in regard to some crimes that are being committed. So part of it is policy, certainly. Part of it is just enforcing the laws that exist. And part of it is expectations of people. If you expect them to improve, many will. If you don't expect them to improve, many won't.
That's a very good point. It's the same thing in school, isn't it? When you had an expectation, you rose to the occasion. But if everybody thought that you could just do what you wanted, you know, I think it just feeds the lowest common denominator when there's no expectations or there's excuses made for why you can't. Then you're going to self-fulfill. And what about these drug policies where it's now legal for various recreational drugs? Did that contribute, do you think, to this societal acceptance? And of course, since you accepted,
if you legalize something, you're going to have more of it.
It's a good point.
That's a pretty clear point. I think the experiments in drug legalization, you know, we were told the war on drugs doesn't work and so forth. But Oregon has legalized drugs and Colorado has legalized drugs to a certain degree. And we're certainly finding in Oregon that it's a catastrophe. So I think that, you know, we talk about the states as test tubes mm-hmm. for policies. Well, there have been some states that are trying this drug legalization approach, and it's making matters much, much worse, and certainly contributes to the inability to get people off the streets because they're engaging in dysfunctional behavior that we have decided to legalize because we no longer have the grit to enforce these kinds of laws that I think are actually failing the people that we're supposedly helping.
It just seems, I don't know how to put this, but it's a lack of respect for humanity. You're saying that you want to help somebody, get them into a home and get them to be, I mean, I assume this is what it wants, to be productive citizens, yet you don't provide them any means to do that. You lower the floor further, and then you make it hard for them, even if they wanted to. There's no program that's actually designed to help them. So what I'm seeing is there's a pipeline for mental illness to the prison, which is huge. There is, I don't even know, we didn't even talk about families per se, but I can imagine this breaking the family unit because it's so under stress, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the underpinning of society, is having functional units, family, friends, and being able to pursue, you should be doing better as you get older, not worried about whether you're going to survive. It's just a whole different mentality of siege and being in a combat situation. And it just breeds everything to keep going in the pathway that it's going, don't you think?
Yeah, and I think the increased collapse of religious faith has a part in this too.
Well, there's been a war on that.
I'm not a proselytizer or anything, but I do think it has a part in this.
I would have to agree. But it's not just a passive. It's very actively against it. You know, there's all sorts of demonstrations demonizing anybody who believes in God. No matter the religion, it's about whether you believe God is important or the government. It seems like there's two poles to this. And there's been a concerted effort to push it more towards government. That's the end all be all. Everything else is subservient to that.
I'm not going to argue with you.
Well, I mean, it's about the individual choice. Whether you're, God forbid, in the homeless situation or you have a job and you have the means, I think everybody has to make a conscious choice now to be their brother's keeper, to take personal responsibility for what their actions are, and also to try to stop allowing this thing to have power. It's just taken off and it's gotten fueled by money and apathy, and someone else will do it, or I'm just going to draw myself from the situation. I just don't think it's not sustainable, as I said before. And from an ethical, moral standpoint, because that's really what it does come down to, I totally agree with you. God is number one, but how do people start that process? If you are, God forbid, teetering on the outskirts and you are homeless, how can you withdraw your consent from this situation? I know it's a really broad question.
There are many organizations out there, like the rescue missions I discussed, mm-hmm. the Salvation Army, that have very active and successful programs. And they are helping people. They're helping a lot of people, but there aren't enough of those programs for the entire problem that we're facing. But people who have a motive, who desire to get back to a place of self-sufficiency, there is help there for people, and they can find it in their local community. And those kinds of people, I think, are the easiest to save. The people that are difficult to save are the ones who want to continue to live dissipated lives and not change that, but receive, okay, here's your housing voucher. Now go out and overdose. I mean, that's not loving somebody. That's actually abandoning them.
I couldn't have said it better. On the seconds that we have left, how can people read what you write and also get more information about your organization?
Well, the Discovery Institute's at the Discovery, www.discovery.org, and that you can go into the Center for Wealth and Poverty. I run the Center on Human Exceptionalism and got involved in this issue because I was asked to speak on Capitol Hill on homelessness as a human exceptionalism issue. And I realized, I put some thought into it. My gosh, this is really a crucial human dignity issue in the sense of both helping people in the right way and what people owe the rest of us. I mean, it needs to be reciprocity. If people want to follow my writing, I write about many issues beyond the homeless issue, as you've mentioned. I'm on Twitter at the Wesley J. Smith. I'm on Facebook. You can go to humanize.today. In fact, after you've listened to this podcast, I would urge your listeners to go to my podcast, humanize.today, where I do interview Robert Marbut about these issues, who was Trump's czar. And you can find that interview. I also interview a man, I did this 2 years ago, named Jim Palmer, who's the head of the Orange County Rescue Mission, who described how his organization helps people and the things he's seen in Housing First, of people being allowed to take drugs and live dissipated lives to the point where they're not being helped at all.
Mr. Smith, thank you so much for joining me today. I learned a lot. I feel that everything that we do, nothing is in a vacuum. Every positive step we take, everything we do to help each other is what we should be doing. So again, thank you for everything you do.
Well, thank you, Dr. George. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. And thank you, everybody, for living in the solution.
Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Liberty Talk FM.